From the heart of rural France, this is the Keto Woman podcast, brought to you by me. Hello, keto lovelies. I'm Daisy Brackenhall, and I've spent most of my life struggling with my weight and confidence, and have always had a difficult relationship with food. Even when I finally got to my target weight after weight loss surgery and eating low carb, I couldn't maintain it and I was miserable. I've been keto now for over 2 years and it has given me the freedom to fall in love with food again without the constant gain, loss, guilt, virtue cycle of before. Health and happiness is where it's at now, running on fat. Welcome to the Keto Woman podcast. Each week I'll be chatting to inspirational women, maybe even the odd man, to discover the secrets to their success so that I can share them with you. So what is keto? Keto is a way of eating that enables you to switch your body's main fuel source from sugar to fat. Who doesn't want to be a fat burner, right? But how do we achieve this? A great place to start is by keeping carbs under 20 grams a day. So things like leafy greens and above ground vegetables, plus some nuts and seeds and the incidental carbs you find in things like full fat dairy. Choose delicious fatty proteins and be free and easy with oily dressings on salad and butter on your veggies. Once you're in the swing of things, you can tweak it to suit you. Make your own personalized keto. You'll hear all sorts of ways to keto from my guests. There is no one way to do keto, no one size fits all. I hope to show you just how flexible and fabulous this way of eating can be. I'm not a doctor, and most of my guests won't be either, so we really can't give you medical advice. It's always best to consult your own doctor when making big changes to your diet and lifestyle, because they know you and your medical history, and so have access to the bigger picture. Wouldn't it be helpful to have one place where you could find all the links? Want to sign up to my new Patreon-exclusive Facebook group, Daisy's Lovelies? No problem. How about subscribing to my YouTube channel? Please help me notch up my first 1,000 subscribers by going to links.ketowomanpodcast.com and following the YouTube link. Not following me on Instagram yet? Hit the Instagram button. You get the idea. All the buttons, all the links you need are at links.ketowomanpodcast.com. These next three podcasts are a bit of a cheat. I actually recorded them quite a while ago as a feature for Patreon that ended up not really working out. They are such great content though, I thought it was time to air them. I've been really busy getting ready for Keto Fest, and it seemed like the perfect moment as I was behind with recordings. Plus, they're nice and short, so quicker to edit. The alternative was putting out a repeat episodes, and I really didn't want to do that. I've enjoyed listening to them again, and I hope you do too. One question, three answers. Do you think people with weight to lose need to consider calories if they are experiencing a long plateau when eating a ketogenic diet? First up is my friend Richard Morris. In fact, all three episodes are with people I'm now friends with. What great people I get to meet being a podcaster. Anyway, I digress. Back to Mr. Morris, who, by the time this episode airs, I will be working alongside in the kitchen at RD86 getting ready for Keto Fest. I guarantee you we will be having a giggle or two. You can hear more from Richard in episode 65 and also episode 22 when he came on with Carl Franklin. Richard is a 53-year-old software developer and technical speaker who built financial systems to expose risk on Wall Street and has worked on systems from industrial robots to payroll. At 38, he was the public-facing chief executive of a major software component company when he discovered he had type 2 diabetes. At 40, he retired to devote his time to learning about type 2 diabetes and reversing his own with the ketogenic diet 5 years ago. With Carl Franklin, he founded the Two Keto Dudes podcasts, over 250,000 monthly downloads, and the International Keto Fest event to help popularize the intervention as a treatment for type 2 diabetes. Last year, Richard went back to school to study biochemistry, and he is currently producing videos debunking bad science journalism. If you are at Keto Fest, I know you are going to enjoy Rich's presentation, Why is the Fat Man Hungry, as much as I am. If you can't make Keto Fest, the presentations will be coming to YouTube sometime in the not too distant future for you to enjoy too. You're going to love this.
Okay.
We've actually touched on it in the recording today. Do you think people with weight to lose need to consider calories if they are experiencing a long plateau when eating a ketogenic diet?
So reducing your calories will guarantee to reduce your weight. It doesn't all come off body fat. If you're eating fewer calories than you need to be satiated, then by definition, you don't have enough energy from body fat. And so you need to find energy from other sources. And there are two easy places that your body can get energy from. And it gets them approximately linearly. You will be using lean tissue. So you'll be throwing the furniture on the bonfire to keep yourself warm. So burning lean tissue in your body. And you will be also reducing your metabolic rate, because you know the other easy way to find calories is to make them up from cost savings. So you furlough a few processes like growing hair, growing fingernails, lots of things that are, you know, these are necessary, but, you know, if you didn't do them for one day, your body could probably justify doing that. And so what happens when you eat fewer calories than you need for satiation is that your metabolic rate slows and it becomes harder to calorie restrict, and that's why people yo-yo. So, yeah, definitely having less calories will definitely reduce your weight. It's probably not the best way to do it, though.
Exactly. And for women, something that often gets turned off is menstruation, of course.
Oh, sure. Fertility, yeah.
I remember somebody talking a while ago, they say, your body's very clever and it doesn't think this is a healthy environment in which you should get pregnant. So it's going to turn off menstruation so that you can't get pregnant.
It turns off fertility in men and women. It'll turn off your sex drive as well.
That's a big old warning sign.
Yeah. It'll lower your testosterone if you're a man, and it'll turn off your sex drive.
Yeah. We don't want you to reproduce, thanks. You're not healthy.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there's definitely lots of cost savings that can be made. I mean, people can lose sort of 400 to 800 calories a day in metabolic rate drop just by putting pressure on the caloric intake. And the body fat can only release energy at a certain rate. It's roughly 31.5 calories per pound of body fat per day. And so when you have a caloric restriction that is so great that it puts pressure on that and you can no longer be getting the energy from body fat for one reason or another, then, you know, you're going to get it from these other places.
I've heard you talking about this before, about how the fat person can't access that fat. Because you hear people saying, don't you, no, don't eat high fat, and you should be eating less fat if you're trying to lose weight. You should be eating the fat on your body instead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But there's only a certain point that that's going to work to, isn't it? It's not just this absolute sliding scale where you can minimize the fat you eat right down to a really, really low percentage and automatically dial that percentage up to be taking it off your body instead. It doesn't work like that.
No, thin people can't fast. You'll find that a lot of people who are quote-unquote healthy and shirtless on Facebook are not able to fast for more than a day. And the reason why is because once they've gone through all of the energy in their lipoproteins, they have no energy coming in because they have no ability to supplement their daily energy intakes from body fat. So, yeah, that's certainly the case. But there are other reasons why you won't be able to use fat. So I'm roughly, I have 20 kilos of body fat, so roughly 44 pounds. So I can produce about 1,275 calories per day. So that's not too bad. I mean, 1,200 calorie day, that's not too bad. So I can fast for as long as I want. But somebody who has, let's say somebody who has 10 pounds of body fat on their body, they can only produce 300 calories. What, 315 calories they can produce per day. That's not enough energy to be able to run your day. So that person is now going to be reducing their metabolic rate as much as they can. So they'll go from a metabolic rate of 3,000 down to a metabolic rate of maybe 1,200. And then how do they make the extra savings? They start burning lean tissue. So, you know, that's a really bad situation to be in. The other reason that you might not be able to use body fat is if insulin is high. There are people who, even though they've lost a lot of, 80, 70 pounds of body fat, they still have high levels of fasted insulin. Insulin has an effect, two effects when it comes to getting energy from storage into use. The first is that insulin will basically tell your fat cells, we're going to concentrate on glucose now. So I want you to hoover up all of the lipids, all of the energy in circulation. I wanted you to get all of the fats out of circulation and store them. And I want you to pull as much glucose as you can also out of storage because we're focusing on glucose. So that's the signal that insulin gives the fat cell. So, you know, if your insulin is high, even when you eat nothing, if your fasted insulin is high, if it's above 14, your fat cells are just sucking up all of that energy that they can, irrespective of how much energy you have available to you. And this explains the paradox of why the fat man is hungry all the time and has no energy to do anything. That's at the source. And then the other part is at the sink for energy. Insulin will prevent you from being able to get fatty acids into your mitochondria to be used for energy. And there's a bunch of ways that that happens, but in a type 2 diabetic, in somebody who's hyperinsulinemic, they could have a 50-fold inhibition over a normal person in terms of getting fat from circulation into their mitochondria to be burned. This is part of the reason why people who are hyperinsulinemic have really high triglycerides, because they can't use fat for energy. It just pulls in their circulation. They can no longer store it in their body fat because their body fat is full to capacity, but they're not burning it. As soon as you drop insulin enough that they can burn their body fat or burn the energy, the fatty acids that are pulling in their circulation, all of a sudden their triglycerides drop. So if your insulin is high, that may be impacting how fast or the rate that you can burn fatty acids. And so these are all factors that people think, you know, if I've got 10 pounds of body fat on me, that's roughly about 3,500 calories per pound of body fat. So I've got 30,000 calories. I need to go do 30,000 calories of exercise and then I'll have zero pounds of body fat on me. It doesn't work that way. It's a very complicated picture.
So just how insulin sensitive or resistant you are, is that going to impact then how much you can pull from your body fat? So for someone like me who had, so basically I was twice my weight, so I had 140 odd pounds of excess body weight. I wasn't insulin resistant. I've always stayed quite insulin sensitive. My blood markers were always quite good. Does that mean that, and maybe that was why something like a very highly restrictive procedure like the gastric sleeve would work well, would I be the kind of person who could pull more?
Yes.
From my body fat?
So hyperinsulinemia goes hand in hand with insulin resistance. Hyperinsulinemia just means you have high insulin. And you have high insulin, there's an argument over whether high insulin causes insulin resistance or insulin resistance causes high insulin. My attitude is that it doesn't really matter. They both affect each other and they both contribute to each other. And once you get started on this, it's a sort of a Jacob's ladder. It just never stops. If you're not insulin resistant, then you're able to lower insulin based on the signals of what you eat. And so you would be able to, you probably with a caloric restriction, you were probably able to get to a lower body weight than somebody who was insulin resistant and went through the same process.
Right. But I would be able to pull more from my body fat. When you talk about the ability of only being able to pull so much, if you're much more insulin sensitive,
yeah,
you can pull more. So you can actually be someone who potentially could benefit when you're wanting to lose weight from reducing calories a bit.
Yes. Definitely. If you're insulin sensitive, then you have access to more fat as fuel to turn into energy. And if you're insulin sensitive and your insulin is low, you're in a wonderful state. You know, if you're insulin sensitive and you go on a ketogenic diet, what happens generally is that you lose a lot of weight and you get down to normal body weight very quickly. If you're insulin resistant and you have a high underlying fasted insulin levels, then you will alight at a higher body weight. You will plateau at a higher body weight. And then it's just a matter of working out what tissue is causing the insulin to be high. It's certainly, once you've lost 30, 40 pounds of body fat, it's no longer a physical capacity limit on your body fat that's caused, it's not insulin resistance in your body fat that's causing your insulin to be high. It's another tissue that's doing the damage. It could be your hypothalamus, it could be your pancreas, it could be your liver, it could be your muscles. Could be your immune system is also able to modulate insulin secretion. So, yeah, all of these things. So at that point, this is why my advice is keep calm and keto on. Get to your plateau and then keep calm and keto on. And, and enough time at that weight, and you'll find what tissue was doing the damage. And, you know, it could be sleep. It could be, there's a bunch of things that you can do. You know, relaxation, they're all part of keeping calm and carrying on. But, you know, I suggest not to calorie restrict. But if, you know, if you're naturally insulin sensitive, if you've done a fasted insulin test and you can get down to 4 or lower, go for it. Calorie restrict, yeah, give it a go.
I think there are so many other things to consider before you do that. So yes, if you know in your heart of hearts that you're eating too much, and I don't like to really pinpoint it as calories, but you're just taking in too much energy. If you know you have a tendency to over, I do with certain kind of foods, I eat too much of them. I know I do. So if you know that you're taking it, you can calorie restrict in the sense that you can reduce your intake a bit, maybe by limiting the things that you know you have a tendency to overeat. But going past that, no, there's more likely going to be something else that's going on.
Yeah.
And like you say, once you start reducing your calories too much, then you'll start seeing other things that happen. And that's certainly something that happened with me. And it's so typical in the weight loss surgery community that they should actually say, you are going to suffer significant hair loss between months 3 to 6.
Right.
And then it should start coming back months 6 to 9. But it's so typical. But it's interesting, actually, that it seems very typical in the keto community. Now, do you think that that's just a byproduct of natural calorie restriction? Because people often tend to end up eating fewer calories when they're eating ketogenically because their appetite goes down? Or do you think that there's another mechanism going on there too?
There's a lot of chicken and egg issues here. One of the things that will signify your body to make cost savings, and those cost savings will cause your body to stop growing hair, telogen effluvium, where all of the hair that is probably going to fall out over the next year decides all to do it in 1 week. you know, all the follicles. So all of those things happen when you have an energy shock. Now, when you first go ketogenic, you are not fat adapted, but you're not giving your body carbohydrates. So you are actually giving it a shock. You're actually giving it not enough energy, so it has to adapt.
Ah, right. So it's not so much about the calories. It's just the shock to switching that fuel source.
Yeah. It doesn't happen to everybody. Some people are able, some people are more adaptable.
No, but it does seem to happen a lot, I've noticed.
But if it doesn't happen to you when you first go ketogenic, then, you know, 7, 8, 9 months down the road when you hit your plateau and then you decide, well, I'm going to reduce my food intake because, you know, I've been increasing my food intake as I got closer to my plateau, which is, this is Stephen Finney's argument. This is his 4 charts. This is what he's saying. As you get closer to your ultimate plateau, you start to eat more calories spontaneously. And he's explaining how the homeostasis works to alight you on that plateau. If you then decide, oh, well, I'm obviously eating too much, I'm going to eat less, and then you eat less and now you have an energy deficit, if you didn't lose hair in the first days of keto, that's when you're going to lose, you know, lose a lot of hair. And, you know, your fingertips will be cold and you, you know, I've heard of people with toenails and fingernails falling out and, you know, all sorts of lack of energy. It's just, you know, and then fertility, cost savings, women stop their menstruation and men lose their sex drive. And, you know, there's all these kinds of things that happen when your body is in an energy deficit, in an emergency, essentially. It's a 3-alarm emergency.
Mm. And you talk about eating to satiety and you seem to have that dialed in really well. And it's something that I struggle with and I know a lot of people do. And I think that's where you potentially have to start looking at restriction, but not really restriction of calories, but restriction of certain food types. Because as soon as I dial in a stricter diet, which is not, and I've counted the calories, it is not low on calories at all.
No.
But when I stick very much, probably cut out things like dairy, things like nuts, nut flours, treat type things with sweeteners in, if I eat very basically and really nice and high fat, just protein and simple vegetables and lots of fat, I do find my appetite comes down a little bit, but those calories are up there. I doubt I come in at less than 2,000 a day.
Yeah.
But yet my weight will start coming down. So it is sometimes I think about being a little bit restrictive, but not actually with the calories, actually about different foods.
I totally agree. We can be mindlessly eating food that has a little bit of carbohydrates in it. And if we eat too much of it, we could be eating more carbohydrates than we really know about. And so that's why if you're in that state and you want to work out what's happening, it's always a good idea to start a food diary so that you're mindfully eating. Mm-hmm. And that way you're keeping track of things. But, you know, we tend to sort of fall into this trap as humans of trying to find magical molecules, or in terms of pills, these are magical molecules, or magical foods that you can eat as much of and not gain weight. You know, celery has negative calories, so you know, you burn up more calories chewing it. And so people eat, it's horrible stuff, you know. But we tend to get into this situation where we think, oh, you know, there must be good foods and bad food. There must be magical foods that have a high satiety and there must be foods that have a low satiety. One of the things that has the highest satiety is, it's just getting enough fat energy is highly satiating. Or ketones, exogenous ketones, are extremely satiating. And the reason why is because we have energy at the cellular level. So we're not energy deprived at the cellular level, because ketones we can get energy from no matter what our insulin status is. Another example is when I wake up and I've been fasted 3 days, I am satiated like nothing else, waking up, eating nothing. You know, so where does nothing sit on the satiation index? of satiating foods, nothing is the most satiating, one of the most satiating foods that I've ever had. But it's all in context. I mean, satiation is not an emergent property of food. It's an emergent property of humans in a particular context. And, you know, this context is having adequate energy at a cellular level.
And fat just gets picked on because it's so much more calorie dense. You know, it's more than twice, just a bit more than twice the calories of the equal amount of carbohydrates or protein, isn't it? So it always gets picked on, and you will see in certain groups, well, you know, you need to start reducing your fat. You know, don't eat fat bombs and don't put fat in your coffee and things like that. And to a certain extent, I do agree with that, but not for the same reason. I don't agree with reducing it because of the caloric content. It goes back to the food group things. It goes back to making it a little less palatable. When you make it really palatable by adding sweetener to fat and making fat bombs and flavors and things like that, so it basically becomes sweets that are just delicious that you can pop for ages. If you just give somebody a lump of butter, and also actually to a certain extent putting it in a drink, it goes down in a different way.
Yeah, liquid calories have a different mechanism for satiation.
Yeah, exactly. But eating fat when it's attached to a pork chop, or, you know, eating lumps of butter, you literally can't do. It's not that palatable, is it? I mean, it's palatable, it's delicious, but it's not palatable in the same way as when you've turned it into a sweet.
You'd be surprised. There's a lot of people on the internet who think that there's a whole bunch of people out there drinking pure butter.
Yeah, exactly. We're literally putting these sticks of butter in the coffee. I love that meme that has a stick of butter literally sticking out of a cup of coffee. And the first thing that I think when I look at that is, well, that's not a hot cup of coffee, or the stick of butter would be.
Exactly. I like adding butter to vegetables. I follow Sarah Halberg's principle of never eating vegetables without some fat.
Yes, making them palatable.
Yeah, but, you know, I don't need a lot of butter. Although I did have hollandaise today. I made myself some protein bread company pancakes, and I made little pikelets. So pikelets are about sort of like English muffin sized.
Yeah, they're like squished crumpets, aren't they, pikelets?
Exactly. And I had two of them for dinner. One had ham, a poached egg, and hollandaise. Mm. That was an eggs benny. And the other one had spinach and salmon, poached salmon, and a poached egg and hollandaise as well. So nice. That was eggs florentine.
Eggs florentine with what's it called when the salmon's on it? Is it? It's not a royale,
I think,
or
it's
something.
Eggs florentine. Oh, it might be royale, yeah, because it's spinach.
When the salmon's on there. Florentine is the spinach, but I'm not sure what it is when it's the salmon. I do eat a lot of butter, I have to say. I do eat a lot of butter. I love it in my scrambled eggs. I slather it on vegetables, but yes, it's all about the context for me. It's what you're mixing it with.
Absolutely.
I was intrigued, actually. I will let you go in a minute. That lupin flour, and I've been reading about this and trying to find out what the carb content of things. It's quite big in Australia, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's one of these new emergent low-carb flours.
It is. Lupin is a legume like peanuts. Mm-hmm. It's closely related to peanuts. And so people who have peanut allergies can often have allergies to lupin. But lupin is a flour that's used in the protein bread pancakes I was talking about. And there are three varieties. There's a European variety that's been, a French variety that's been eaten for thousands of years. And there's a South American variety as well. And then there's an Australian variety, a sweet lupin. Doesn't actually have sugar in it. It's just called sweet because of the flours. But anyway, the Australian variety is slightly less allergenic. Australia has really high peanut allergies. We have more peanut allergies amongst kids than almost anywhere in the world. Yeah. In fact, we have very high rates of asthma and a lot of these autoimmune diseases. But lupin is less allergenic than South American and European versions. I just posted on Facebook a nice breakfast I had, and I got called to task about promoting lupin.
Yeah, I saw it.
That's one of the reasons why I don't want to be a keto dude anymore, because I was just having breakfast. I wasn't promoting lupin, and I don't have a problem myself with allergies. And so, anyway, it was a delicious breakfast.
It's reminded me, actually, I do have a jar. It cropped up in Lidl. It was Spanish week, so presumably they're Spanish lupins, but not the flour, but the actual lupins in a jar. I used to love tuna and butter bean salad.
Ooh,
and so
nice.
I'm envisaging making a similar thing with these lupin beans because they do seem to be very low in carbs. And I don't know what they taste like. They might taste disgusting, but I must crack open the jar and see what they're like.
So I'm in the process of making some ham stock from all the ham we had left over from Christmas, and I'm going to use French blue lentils with that to make a ham and split pea soup using French lentils.
French blue lentils?
Yeah.
What are they? So not pre lentils then? What are blue lentils?
I don't know. They're just the lowest calorie legume that I can find.
Ah, interesting.
They're quite low in, actually not low in calories, low in carbohydrates.
Oh, I'd be interested to know. I've never heard of them. Considering I'm in France, pre lentils are the things that normally crop up.
Yeah.
But blue lentils, right? I should be straight on Google now. Because I do like to have, those things occasionally. They're the kind of things before I started keto, when I was more moderate carb, I would have a few things like quinoa and lentils and things like that. I do potentially like to have them occasionally. Right. Well, thank you very much. Fabulous having this extra bit.
You're welcome, Daisy. It's a pleasure as always.
To get the resources and links from this show, please go to ketowomanpodcast.com/episodes. Please share this podcast with as many people as possible by sharing one of my links or just taking a screenshot of an episode that you enjoyed. Reviews really help raise the profile of the podcast, which gets it in front of more people, but also helps me attract a wide variety of guests. So please take a minute to leave a review on whichever podcast app or platform you like to listen on. It doesn't go unnoticed by me, the people who regularly like, share and comment on my posts. Your support really does mean the world to me. Thank you. Are you enjoying this podcast? Help me make more episodes and videos by making a pledge at my Patreon page, patreon.com/ketowoman. Or simply hit the support button on the Keto Woman Podcast website. Don't forget to join in the fun on the Keto Woman Podcast Instagram and Facebook pages, and Daisy_KetoWoman on Twitter. Are you my next extraordinary woman? Maybe you've got an idea for a show, a topic you would like to hear about. Let me know how I can tickle your earbuds by dropping me a line at daisy@ketowomanpodcast.com. This week's end quote is from Mirai Gigliano. Once you have to start counting calories, it takes away from the joy of eating. Bye-bye, keto lovelies.